Hello, my name is Mark Gibson, and you're listening to the podcast version of the Chagask Signpost Series, a weekly webinar that promotes and examines sustainability in Irish farming.
Hello, and a very good morning to you. You're welcome to today's Signpost webinar. We hope you're keeping safe and well. Today, we're going to be talking about water quality, and we've seen plenty of water across the country over the last number of months, and I'm sure every farmer in the country now is maybe looking forward to a break in all the sheer volume of water that we've been seeing falling on the country over the last number of months. But today we're going to be discussing how healthy our water bodies are in Ireland and what farmers are doing and what they can further do to improve the status of our waters. And we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Jenny Deacon, who is Senior Catchment Scientist with the Environmental Protection Agency. And Jenny's going to be discussing water quality and agriculture challenges and opportunities. Jenny, you're welcome back to the Signpost webinar.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's great the series has kept going. This is my third time, so it's an excellent resource.
Yes, it's fantastic. It's hard to believe we're almost at our 200th episode. This is episode 199, so we're delighted to look. We're just absolutely delighted with the support that's out there for the webinar. Jenny, you're going to be talking to us about giving us an overview of the direction of travel and water quality. If I could ask you just, why is it so important that we protect our water quality? So it's a very basic question, but what does it mean to having good water status in this country?
It's a good question, Mark. And sometimes it's easy to just jump straight into the science of how is it and how do we fix it and what we have to do without actually thinking about why is it important? I suppose, we all need water resources for drinking and for our livelihoods and to carry on industry. Agriculture depends on a good, clean source of water. But also it's fundamental, really, to healthy ecosystems. And from healthy ecosystems stems healthy people and healthy planet and healthy food. So it really is fundamental. And it's good to highlight that at the start, actually. Why is it important?
Yeah, well, it's something we often launch into the technical side of things without really taking stock. And Pat, you've been spending a lot of your career to date on improving water quality, a lot of measures being introduced through Chagask Nutrient Management Planning, the ASA program being probably one of the flagship programs. How is that going?
ASA program going very well, very, very busy. There's also been the launch. I suppose one of the challenges we had with the ASA program was when we went out to farms, we got a lot of support for farmers, but there was certain issues that were quite expensive to put in place. And thankfully, the Department of Ag and the Department of Housing, Heritage and local government heritage have come along and put together a fund under an EIP now to support measures in those areas for action. So that was launched there a couple of weeks ago. And it's a real positive. It gives us an extra boost to really get some of those measures that are going to make a difference into place on farms.
Yeah, no, it's really welcome. And I believe it's a little bit more straightforward in terms of red tape and so forth. So it's great that those measures can be targeted. And I think, Jenny, that's what we're going to be talking about today, is that targeting of measures. So I know you have some slides to share with us. So maybe if you want to to share those, and we'll chat to you after the presentation.
Thanks very much, Mark. And thanks again for the opportunity to come and join you today to talk about water quality and agriculture and the challenges and opportunities, as you said. So first up, I'm going to just spend a couple of slides talking about what is water quality, because it means different things to different people. And I want to just give a highlight of when we talk about water quality, what we mean and how we measure it and how often we measure it. So first up, water quality really under the Water Framework Directive is all about what's living in the water and how healthy their living spaces or their supporting conditions are. So we measure how healthy the biological elements are that are in the water. So that's the plants, the insects, the algae, the fish. And those together with the supporting conditions, which are what's in the water itself. So the physical chemical elements like nitrogen, phosphorus, ammonium, temperature, oxygen, pH, and chemicals. And then the hydromorphology elements, which is essentially about the habitat condition. So what's the flow like? What's the quantity of water like, or levels if it's a lake? The continuity is about how the rivers can flow from the mountains to the sea. Are the barriers, are they connected with the floodplain? And then the physical habitat condition in the rivers or lakes or estuaries or coastal waters themselves. And all of those different elements go together to make up ecological status, which gives us a picture of how healthy our water resources are. The biological elements in particular are very useful because they give you an integrated picture of how water quality has gone over the last number of weeks, months, and years, because they integrate. They're like the canary in the coal mine, I suppose. And they give us a picture of what water quality was like on a day that perhaps we didn't happen to be out sampling. So targeting the measures then are best targeted at the supporting conditions. We talk a lot in the agriculture space about nitrogen and phosphorus, but there are those other elements that we look at as well. So how often do we monitor all these things? Well, the biological elements are once every 3 years for the most part. They're the integrated overview, as I said. The physicochemical elements are several times annually, ranging from monthly to quarterly. And then we do some of the more expensive chemicals just once every 6 years. Those would be the, you know, the pharmachemicals and the more expensive list of substances we have to look at. The hydromorphology elements then, the habitat conditions, they are looked at once every 3 years with the biological elements. And we have a large number of water bodies that we monitor. There's about 2,400 rivers, over 200 lakes, 122 estuaries and coastal waters, and 512 groundwater. So it's quite an extensive monitoring program by European standards. And this is what the overall integrated picture is. So on the left, you can see our overall ecological status. It's divided up. The classification scheme has the five colors there, ranging from blue, which is high, down through good, moderate, poor, and bad. Thankfully, we don't have too many bad water bodies in Ireland. But you can see in the map and in the pie chart there on the left, there's quite a wide distribution of the kind of yellows and oranges, which are the unsatisfactory moderates and poors. On the right then, on the top panel, you can see how that breaks down for each of the water body types. So the rivers, the lakes, the transitional waters, which are our estuaries, and the coastal waters. In general, our coastal waters are in the best condition, with a lot more of those pie charts in the blues and the greens. The rivers and the transitional waters are struggling the most. About half our rivers are in good condition. And it's only 38% for our transitional waters. And they're at the bottom ends of the catchments. And so they receive the brunt, I suppose, of all of our activities upstream, right back up into the middle of the country. So there's a lot of work to do in rivers and estuaries. In the bottom right panel, then, you can see how those status classes and the proportion in each class has changed over the last number of years. So the bottom bar there is 2007-09 period. And the top bar is the most recent bar there, which is 2016 to 2021. So you can see over that period of a decade and a half, just over, the proportion that's left of the black line, the goods and the highs, has come down. And we've seen an increase in the moderates, unfortunately. But on the positive side, we are reducing the bads down from 33 to 16. And we did have a slight improvement in the high status class in the last assessment compared to the one previous. So there are green shoots of recovery. There's lots of positive improvements happening in some places, but we do see them getting offset by declines elsewhere, which is disappointing. So that's where one of the areas really where we need to focus is to stop those declines so that the good work that is going on can dominate and we end up with an overall net improvement. So what are the impacts then that cause the ecological status to not be where we'd like it to be? Well, the biggest contributor is the nutrients, the excess nitrogen and phosphorus, and that leads to eutrophication. And you can see in the pictures what that looks like. Those are big overgrowths of algae, which suck up the oxygen out of the system and make it a very unsatisfactory environment for the plants and the insects and the fish. So eutrophication and these excess nutrients are our biggest issue nationally. But following close behind, you can see in the bar chart there, the morphology category. And this is this habitat conditions that I mentioned. So increasingly, we're seeing that that is becoming more and more important. As we get a control of our nutrients, we're going to need to look in the future more towards these physical habitat conditions. But more on that another day, perhaps. So to have a look then in more detail at the nutrients. So these are our key nutrient water quality indicators from our last EPA report, which was our annual indicators report, which came out last year based on data up to 2022. So the map on the left and the chart on the left is the nitrate situation. You can see in the chart, again, we've used the same colors for blues and greens are good, and the more orangey, yellow and red colors not so good. So you can see there's definitely an issue with the nitrate concentrations in the south and southeast. And I pulled out the southeast chart there below the map for the period 2010 to 22. So we can see the average annual nitrate concentrations nationally, or in the southeast rather, this is the southeast region chart, how they've tracked over time. So I suppose in short, over the first part of the last decade, the first half of it, they were reasonably stable. We had an increase then from the middle of the 2000s up to a peak in 2018-19, which we've talked about before on different occasions. And then we've seen an improvement since then, and it's sort of tracking along there a bit higher than we would like. So you can see the three different colored lines on that chart. The bottom blue line is the standard to support high ecological status. The green is the line that supports good ecological status. And the orange is the line that supports healthy estuaries. So you can see that the concentrations there for the last half of the last decade have been too high in the southeast to support the healthy estuaries that we need. The middle block then, the phosphorus, you can see a different pattern to the nitrogen. The phosphorus problems tend to track where the soils are most poorly draining. So you can see the hotspots there around the border, Cavan, Monaghan, Louth, Meath. There's a patch in Limerick as well. And then there are pockets in different places. That's usually down to the soil type. The heavier soils are the riskiest soils for losing phosphorus. Whereas in contrast, the more freely draining soils in the southeast are the soils where we lose the nitrate the most. So in terms of the chart then, I've put in the national phosphorus chart there. Again, the colored lines, the blue is the high status horizontal line there, and the green is the standard for good status. So in general, overall, phosphorus is tracking along okay, reasonably stabilized in recent years, but there are definitely hotspots when you zoom into those local areas, and you can see that on the map. The estuary situation then, there's definitely difficulties with the estuaries, in particular along the south coast. Estuaries respond to high levels of nitrate and phosphorus indeed, but certainly the high levels of nitrate that we're seeing in the south and southeast are manifesting in the poorer ecological outcomes in the estuaries along the south coast as well. And the chart there shows the loads of nitrogen in the estuaries over the same period. Again, you can see the peak there around the 20,000 or 2018-19 period, where we had a combination of the drought and our highest national fertilizer use at that time. But since then, we have come down a bit, which is positive. So what's causing the high nitrogen and phosphorus concentrations then on water? So we do assessments of the pressures impacting on waters. We look at all pressures, not just agriculture. Today, obviously, we're focusing on agriculture, but I did put in the urban wastewater chart as well, just to bring a bit of a balance to the other types of assessments that we do. So how do we assess the pressures is a question we often get asked. Well, it's a very comprehensive process involving ourselves, the experiences and data and knowledge and expertise of the local authorities, and also other public bodies like IFI, the Forest Service, National Parks and Wildlife, etc. It's a multiple lines of evidence approach that starts with the monitoring data. And we have all the monitoring data that I've mentioned earlier, but we also have an awful lot of information on the activities that are going on in the landscape in terms of where the septic tanks are. We have monitoring upstream and downstream of urban wastewater treatment plants. We know where the forestry activities are going on, et cetera, et cetera. So in total, we use over 140 data sets and various models of tools to help us model the nutrient transfer through the landscape into our water bodies. So we can see, and we do our assessment water body by water body, case by case, to make that link between what's actually happening in the water in terms of water quality and then what the drivers might be back up into the landscape. Waters can be impacted by more than one pressure, which is an important note as well. Over half of our water bodies have more than one pressure. And so in order for us to see the improvements in water quality that we're looking for, all of the pressures need to be addressed. And so that's why there's a real focus on the working together approach through LawPro and the regional operational committees and structures that are in place to support the achievement of good water quality. So we've developed then and taken the science a little bit further to have a look at where do we need to target agricultural measures, where there's an issue that we know is being driven by agricultural activities. So this is our targeting agricultural measures map. The different colours on it relate to the different types of issues in the water that we see. So the oranges are the places where we need measures to reduce nitrate concentrations. I'll just flick all these up, actually, so they don't. Yeah, so actually I'll start with the blues. The blues, the navy flags, as we call them, are where we need measures to reduce the phosphorus concentrations in the water. And those types of measures are about, I mentioned the poorly draining soils or the heavier soils. The types of measures we need are to intercept the overland flow or the runoff from those soils, which brings the sediment and the phosphorus and the chemical into the waters. So it's about breaking the pathway in those blue areas. The red areas then are where we see high ammonium in the waters, and that's often a signal that there's a point source nearby. And so those are places where particular focus could be targeted at the farmyard. The orange flags then, the orange areas on the map, are places where we need measures to reduce nitrogen losses. And that's about reducing the nitrogen leaching and controlling the losses at source. So it's about reducing the nitrogen surplus, really, and being as efficient as possible. And then the white areas are places where we need just ongoing good practice and measures to protect the good water quality that's there, or else maybe there's water quality issues, but they're not attributed to agriculture. So those are the areas in the white where it's measures to protect and prevent further deterioration, which will offset the improvements that we're seeing elsewhere. So our tagline really is about, it's about the right measure in the right place. So nitrogen and phosphorus, as we know, behave very differently in the landscape. You can see, I've showed you on the maps there, that they become problems in different areas because of the different soil types and the different activities that are going on. So if we look to the left first and talk about phosphorus first. So the poorly draining soils are the key areas of high risk for phosphorus loss. And this is where we get overland flow, which, as I mentioned, brings the phosphorus and often the sediment and chemical with it. You don't need to have a high farming intensity to lose enough phosphorus to cause a water quality problem. The standard is very low before it causes ecological impact. And so it doesn't take a high level of intensity at all. And so it's an issue for all farms, really, and those poorly draining soils are very challenging in general. The measure is about breaking the pathway, as I said, but if that is achievable, then the lag time to see the improvement in terms of water quality can be quite short in terms of weeks to months. Phosphorus is a key issue for rivers and lakes, and so it nationally, it's our biggest issue. On the right-hand side, then, these are typical nitrogen leaky landscape there in the photo in County Kilkenny. It's the freely draining soils, as I mentioned. The surplus nitrogen goes down through the soils into the groundwater. There is, in these scenarios, a strong relationship with intensity. Nitrogen is a slippery molecule, and the more you use, the more you lose. Really, that's the bottom line. So there is a good relationship with intensity in those freely draining soil areas. It needs source control, as I mentioned. The lag time can be a bit longer. It can be months to years, depending on how thick the subsoils are, what level of intensity is there, and how close the pathway or the source is to the stream. where you pick it up, and it goes all the way down then and into the estuaries and coastal waters where it really impacts the ecology. So different types of measures are needed then to address the different issues that we have. So to help further target the measures at local scale, we've produced a series of pollution impact potential maps, or the PIP maps. Some of you may have heard of them. So if we look at the phosphorus PIP maps first, the picture shows these are the types of focused flow delivery paths, as we call them, where the overland flow or the wet ground in field occurs. And this is where we get the overland flow and the runoff bringing the sediment and the phosphorus into the nearby streams. We've over 1,000 water bodies that are impacted by excess phosphorus. And we've developed a series of these PIP maps, or critical source area maps, which show where these hotspots are in the landscape. And the map on the bottom right there shows you the darker the blue, the higher the risk in terms of the soil types and the activities that are going on the land. And then the orange and red squiggly lines then show you where these focused flow delivery paths are. And the red circles show you where those flow paths intercept the river or the watercourse. And those are the best places where we can pinpoint and target the measures to break the pathway. Overall, we can really pin down now using these maps as a guide where the measures can be best targeted. They are only a guide, though. They do need to be ground truth. There are places in the landscape where the overland flow paths have been drained, for example, and it might no longer be wet. So they definitely do need to be ground truth, but they can certainly give an idea. And they're available up online, and they're being used by ASAP already to target the actions in the field. We also have a series of nitrate PIP maps, which show the highest risky areas for nitrate. And so the two maps on the left here are little excerpts of the Timalee catchment in Cork, the ACP catchment, and Ballykinnew then in Wexford. And the Timalee catchment has freely draining soils and a reasonably high intensity of activity. And there, so it's very high risk. The darker the purple, the higher the risk of leaking of nitrogen. And we see that reflected in the nitrogen concentration in Timalee, where it's up over 5 milligrams per litre, and it's come down actually since this chart was developed, but it's in and around the 5 at the moment, I understand. In Ballykinnew then, the soils are much more, much heavier, apart from a little area in the southern part of the catchment, and it's much lower risk of nitrogen loss in this kind of scenario. Again, we see that reflected in the nitrogen concentration in Ballykinnew. But conversely, Ballykinnew with its heavier soils is much higher risk for phosphorus loss, and we see that reflected in the Ballykinnew data. So these maps are available nationally, up online, and again being used by ASAP. So we're able to have a look at all of the evidence that we've got and look at the scale of nitrogen reductions that are needed. Nitrogen's a particular focus at the moment with all the interest in the derogation. So this was a piece of work that we did, published in 2021, where we looked at the monitoring data that we have and the needs of the estuaries and the rivers, and looked at how much nitrogen reduction would be needed to get us back to within healthy targets in the river. And on foot of that analysis, we could see that the Barrow and the Slaney came out as needing the highest reductions, over 50% reductions in losses. And then there was a range of different amounts needed, going from a very small amount, a few percent, like down in Cork, for example, in the Lee, it's only 1% reduction. So we're not far off where we need to be there, up to kind of averaged, I suppose, around 20%. Now, this piece of analysis was done based on mean concentrations of 2017-19, and we are updating this at the moment to give a more updated picture, which will show that we need less reductions now. We have improved since this 2018-2019 period. We have a lot of targets in various pieces of action plans and legislation to reduce the nitrogen losses. There's the target in Food Vision, for example, to reduce nitrogen losses by 50%. And then there's a target in AgClimatise to reduce chemical use from 408,000 tonnes to 325,000 tonnes, which would be a reduction of 20%. And these targets are really important. They were set largely for climate targets, but we can also get a water win out of them if we can target them into the places where we need the highest risk areas, where we need those reductions for water quality as well. And farmers are doing a lot. So that's really important to highlight. You know, the preliminary data for 2023 shows that chemical nitrogen use has come down to 281,000 tonnes. So we've already exceeded the targets that were set in Ag Climatise, which is brilliant. But they are national targets, so they do need to be spatially targeted for water into these highest risk areas. But we do have the tools available to help us do that. So the challenges then for water quality. I suppose first up, really, it's about consistency in the messaging. We know what has to be done. We have the tools. We have the supports, which we'll talk about now in the next slide. It's really about the messaging, consistency and agreement in the messaging with all actors, including the media. And also, I think it's about winning the hearts and minds. You asked at the start, Mark, about why do we need to do this? Why is it important? If we don't win the hearts and minds to actually make the changes that are needed, the practice changes to reduce these nutrients, then we will continue to see the difficulties that we have with the water quality. Actions need to be targeted. We have the science, as I said. We know what needs to be done. We just need to cut to the chase. I have that in red there. That's the right measure in the right place. We also need to reach a critical mass of farmers in these risky areas, in these hotspots, using the tools that we have. Because the links between different farms in the landscape with the different soil types that we have and the different farm practices, the links between each farm and the river is different. And what happens in the highest risk areas is what drives the overall catchment outcome. And so we need to see a critical mass of change happening in those riskiest areas in order to see the change manifested in the rivers and the estuaries downstream. So we do need a critical mass of farmers to get on board. Persistence, I think, is important too, and enduring practice changes. This is about reducing the nutrients that are being lost from farming practices, not just today or yesterday or tomorrow, but enduring, so that we can see that then translate into the ecological monitoring over time. There's no quick fix, I suppose. The weather is increasingly difficult, there's no doubt. We were talking about this earlier before we came online. You know, this is another wet spring. It's very difficult to find the weather windows to get out. I'm sure everyone's dependent on very busy contractors. Everyone's drawing off them in the same short weather windows. That's a challenge. The weather is going to become increasingly challenging, though, and it's going to be part of climate adaptation. That's going to be needed to be able to farm within the boundaries of the weather and all its vagaries. Important to note that it's not just about compliance. Compliance is important, and you know, it's the first step. As a bare minimum, we need to see full compliance. But we do need, on top of that, genuine reductions in nutrient losses in these critical source areas and at scale, as I mentioned, so that we can get the critical mass. And important to note too that all farmers have a role in this. You know, I showed in the map at the start, the map of ecological status. This isn't just an issue for derogation farmers. It's not just an issue for tillage. It's an issue for everyone for different reasons. We've phosphorus and nitrogen problems happen differently in different parts of the country depending on the soils and the farming going on. But there's a role in water quality for every farmer, depending on the risks that are associated with their farm. It's not always related to farming intensity, as I hope I've demonstrated. The last challenge I'd say too, I have on the list there, is about managing expectations. There is a lot being done. A lot of positive actions are happening on farm. There's every day, it seems, there's a new scheme. Farmers are embracing them. There's a lot being thrown at people. It is going to take time, but we do need to get on with it, I suppose. You know, there are changes that can be made. We have the tools, we have the science. There's lots going on, but we just need to keep the shoulder to the wheel. In terms of opportunities then, There's huge public interest now in water quality and concern. There's huge concern. And while concerns are very difficult, particularly when they're economic concerns, they do drive action and collective action, not just within the farm gate, but also outside the farm gate. But there's also appetite. There's never been a greater time in my 30 years of working in water quality where water quality has been higher on the public agenda. And we do see the political support and the new investment that's coming along with the ASAP program, for example, and LawPro that work with ASAP. That's the Local Authority Waters program. We have the Farming for Water EIP that was mentioned earlier by Pat. And we have resources for new inspectors as well in the local authorities. We have the science and the tools. There's great work going on in the ACP catchments. We have our national monitoring network. We have now our national maps to target the effort. We know what measures need to be taken. And so we have the means to target the right measure in the right place. Many of the actions are actually cost neutral or economically advantageous to the farmer as well, because it's about being more efficient and getting more out of the nutrients so that there isn't a need for insourcing or purchasing or bringing in more feed or fertilizer, for example. We have huge opportunity with the experience now that ASAP has gained over the years, and also then to build on the existing ACIS that we're so fortunate to have in this country. So there's huge support and groundswell out there in terms of expertise and science to help farmers. And I do firmly believe that we can make it happen, but we have to be able to win those hearts and minds, as I mentioned, and bring farmers along on the journey and support them to make whatever changes are necessary on their particular patch. So that's it from me for now. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Jenny, and thanks for keeping on time. And that leaves plenty of time for questions from our audience. And it is delighted to report we have a huge interest in this morning's topic. We have nearly 500 people joining us today. And I want to say a special welcome to our international visitors. We have viewers from New Zealand and across Europe this morning. So, or good evening, should we say, to our viewers in New Zealand. So Jenny, thank you so much for that. And it gives a really, I suppose, a really good update on the kind of current status, where we're at the moment, and what work is going on there across the board between the various support programs. You talked about that enduring practice change needed across the board. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing a general change in attitudes towards water quality? You talked about it being on the top of the political agenda, and you know, society as well are very mindful of where water quality is going. But do you see a shift happening? Because I certainly see a shift in mentality happening amongst the farming community.
I definitely think there is, Mark. Yeah, and I you know, we've heard over the series of webinars, there's huge engagement in this as a topic, for sure. And no farmer gets up in the morning and says, "I'm going to pollute water quality today." That's absolutely not in anyone's mindset. And it's challenging, you know, the weather is becoming ever more challenging. But as I say, I've never known a time where water quality has been higher on the in people's minds. And we have huge opportunities now with the resources and the science and the evidence and the advisory support and the enthusiasm. So I think it's we're at a really positive turning point, I think, with the opportunities in front of us to grasp them.
I liked your phrase there, managing the weather. I said to myself, if only.
I know.
But I presume it's managing our response to
you're right. I should have phrased that better.
No. Just thought it was amusing given the country we're living in. Pat, I mean, there's obviously a huge amount happening across the catchments in the priority areas that have been identified within the ASA program. I mean, what advice would you be offering farmers who are outside of those catchments or those priority areas to get on board this movement now to really improve water quality across Ireland?
Yeah, well, I think one of the, I suppose, the challenges we have is that, and Jenny alluded to it, that everybody who's farming is contributing to the loss of nutrient into water, no matter where they're farming, whether the water quality is in a good status and are poor. But even in those areas where there's good, one of the things that keeps happening is we get improvements in some areas and disimprovements in others. So nobody can rest on their laurels in terms of trying to reduce the loss of nutrients. I think one of the huge challenges that we have and that we're working on is trying to get people to understand the dynamics of how nutrient is mobilized to water. And it is quite complex. But I think without that understanding, the understanding of how the measures can work, and I think people need to understand how measures work to justify the implementation of them. So I think that's one of the huge challenges that we have over the next couple of years is building amongst farmers and amongst those working with farmers the understanding of how a nutrient is mobilized to water, and then to understand how the actions that they can take can effectively stop that mobilization.
Yeah, so we certainly have a huge amount of data now, and it's much more precise. And knowing, you know, what the quality of your own water quality or your local water bodies are. I see we have some nice questions coming through. A lot of questions coming through here, so we probably should get into those straight away, Pat.
Okay, so some specific and then some more general. There's a couple of questions there around the legacy effect of hydromorphological pressures. Should these be discounted from targets to get water bodies to good start status, as some of these are difficult to reverse?
Yes, the hydromorphology issues and the physical habitat conditions can be damaged by a successive series of draining and dredging and straightening and removing of meanders and right clearance of the riparian zone, which is the trees and the shrubs that happen next to the riverbank. Those are really important to provide the healthy ecosystems for the plants and the fish and the insects, etc. So when we see damaged hydromorphology, what that means is we've no vegetation on the banks, the river is straight, it's uniform depth, there's no variation in habitats with riffles and pools, which are ideal, where you get shallow bits and faster water and slower bits and places to hide and lots of different types of food falling in from the banks to eat. So that's what hydromorphology is. It's an awful word, really. It's not very descriptive. But what we're really talking about is the physical habitat conditions that support healthy life in the river. So yes, we do have a lot of rivers that have hydromorphology issues. There's about just over 400 water bodies would be mapped as having hydromorphology as a pressure. And within that category, we have subcategories where the hydromorphological change has happened for a number of different reasons. It can be for flood protection or to provide productive agricultural land, or in urban areas, for example, where you've concreted out the river channel for safety and for development. So the hydromorphology and the river water bodies that are impacted by it are a separate category altogether. So they don't appear in that map that I showed earlier, where I had mapped out agriculture as a significant pressure. Those areas are only about the nutrients. There are more water bodies that are impacted by hydromorphology for all sorts of reasons, and it's hard to disentangle whether it's a driver of the physical change was agriculture or flood protection or urban areas, because it's often all of those things. So they're a different category altogether. Okay. And we count them separately. So yeah, the focus that in today's presentation for me was just the nutrients.
There was a question there, Jenny, just in relation to the upcoming River Basin Management Plan, and what's your assessment of how effective the measures set out in that plan will be in restoring catchments which need reductions in nitrate pollution? And maybe there's a related question there about that targeting of measures and programs. We already have the the ASIP program in certain catchments, you know, is there an argument there for an expansion of that?
Yes, so the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage is busy working on the third River Basin Management Plan. It is close, they tell us, to publication, expected in the coming months. To be honest, though, we've known from the draft River Basin Management Plan that came out 2 years ago and all the work that has been going on since in the interim, broadly what's going to be in it, because it's a continuation of the second cycle plan. ASAP and LAWPRO are the cornerstone within it, I would say, again, and also the need to develop this targeted approach, which will continue. So I think it's no secret, and the department would be fairly open themselves, that trying to achieve good status in all water bodies by 2027 is an inordinate challenge for Ireland, as it is for every other member state. And so the way the department have pitched the plan is that there's a series of quite good measures in it that will take us on the journey. We will be trying to do as much as we can before 2027, but I think it's inevitable that some water bodies will take a little longer to get back to where they need to be beyond 2027.
Okay, a couple of related questions here. I'm confused when you say that compliance is important, but reducing pollution is also important. Surely if I'm compliant, I'm reducing pollution. And there's a second one, I'll throw the two of them at you together. Does Jenny think that applying a one-size-fits-all policy on nitrates regulation on farmers needs to change?
Okay, so yeah, the issue of compliance. So compliance is the basic minimum standard of good practice of farming. And in some places, just achieving compliance will be enough. But in other places, particularly for the nitrate issue, being compliant and having good practice, while critical, is not going to be enough to reduce enough of the nutrients to get the water quality back where it needs to be. And that's, I suppose, where the supplementary measures come in, and the extra support and the extra advisory service and the water EIP comes in. So the state can't pay for compliance. The state can only support measures that go above compliance. And that's the fundamental basics of the water EIP, I suppose, where extra resources will be available to support farmers to put in the measures that will go beyond compliance. With regard to the one size, the comment on one size fits all for nitrogen measures. So Ireland decided way back when we got involved first in the nitrates directive that we would take a whole territory approach, and that we would look at nitrogen and phosphorus together, because both pollutants or both nutrients cause pollution in Ireland is not the same in other member states. Some other member states have chosen to only go with nitrate vulnerable zones, where they map out specific areas that are impacted by nitrogen only, and they drive on specific measures in only in those areas and not in others. That's less appropriate in our Irish conditions, because we're a small country, we have a huge diversity of soil types and different farming practices. And so we've decided as a country to apply our regulations nationally. So there is a kind of a one size fits all in the regulation, and that the same regulations apply to every farmer. But that said, we know from all of the slides that you've seen there earlier that different areas in the landscape affect and move nutrients through the landscape differently. The different soils are critical. And so we do know that we need to take slightly different approaches in different soil types, and that we need to target the measures and target the action using the tools and the science and the advisory support and the water EIP, et cetera, to try and achieve that.
Some okay. Questions here, Jenny, coming in around trying, you know, communities or you know, farmers trying to get a clearer picture of the water quality and their particular water body or stretch of river. Are there opportunities to do that, or test kits available, or how can one get that more detailed information, or is it available on, or what sort of resolution is there available already on the EPA mapping systems?
Okay, so we have all of our water monitoring data up on catchments.ie. It's a mapping system, and you can download spreadsheets of data or zoom into your area on a map and see what the water quality is like in your area. We have a reasonably high resolution, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of locations of monitoring points compared to other member states. We've got 5,000 water bodies, and within that, about 2,400 river water bodies. So a river water body or a stretch that we would monitor would be on average maybe 30 square kilometers. So there'd be a monitoring point roughly for that sort of resolution. So you can zoom in on the maps and see what color your local stream is to get a sense of what the overall ecological status is. And then there are charts and data available as well if you're particularly interested in, we'll say, the nitrogen concentrations in your particular water body. I know, Pat, you're working in Chagos too to get the maps and the data up on NMP online. I think they're up already. Aren't they?
Yeah.
And they're also available on the department's system as the GLAMS, I think, or is it Ag Food? I always get mixed up with those two. But we're certainly keen to get the information out, and we've produced a number of little videos that help try and pinpoint the quickest access into the data, because there's a lot of data in there, and it can be quite difficult, all right, to try and figure out exactly how to go about it. So there are resources there to help you do that.
And I suppose just to reiterate the point you made, the catchments.ie site, if anybody is interested in water quality and interested in water quality in their area, it takes a little bit of work to get your head into it. But when you do and start looking at the different information that's there, there is an incredible amount of information to help pinpoint different issues in different areas. So it's a huge resource.
Yeah, there's still lots and lots of questions coming through here. Well, the question here in relation of the targeting the risk profile of farmers, you know, should those farmers who are considered to be at a higher risk of nutrient loss, should they be getting more scrutiny? I suppose that's happening in a way through the derogation process. But what do you say to that as a general principle, Jenny?
Well, I this is probably a question for Pat as well through the asset program. You know, the when we produce our national maps of and the targeting ag measure map of where the problems are, that information all goes to LawPro. And then LawPro do local science, local stream walks, and they figure out exactly what stretch is the issue and where they can see that there's a farming issue. Now they might have also seen a septic tank issue or a forestry issue, and so they engage with those sectors as well to get their issues sorted. But where there's a farming issue, then they refer it on to Pat's team and the ASAP team. And the ASAP team then use these maps to go and the principles, as Pat said, that's really important, the principles of how nutrients move through the landscape and where the risky areas are. And they use those as a starting point to have the conversation with the farmer. Every farmer knows where the wet patch is in the bottom of the field, but it's just about trying to translate that and think about it in terms of the connection between that and the water quality. So I think to stand back from the detail of that, what I'm saying is we know where the risky areas are. We have basic regulations that are the same one size fits all. We know we need to go beyond that. We have the tools to target the risky areas, and the approach, the national approach at the moment through the River Basin Management Plan is to support farmers in those risky areas, to give them the advice, to provide the water EAP, to the funding is there to help target the right measure in the right place. And so that's supportive, more collaborative, discursive approach we're hoping will bear fruit. Pat, I don't know if you have any extra...
And again, it comes back to making sure that we do everything we can. It comes back to the fact that there is no silver bullet in this space, and that there's an awful lot of different measures going to have to take place with an awful lot of different people. Some relating to the nitrate issue are more common across the landscape, whereas in other areas there may be specific issues causing problems. But we just have to get to the bottom of all of those. Just a question there, Jenny, in relation to the potential role of community, River Trust and other organizations in terms of mobilizing and the potential importance of those organizations in assisting the process.
Yeah, as some of your listeners will know, we have our network of community water officers around the country as part of the overall LawPro umbrella. And there are resources there to help community groups to get up and running, to take on projects. There's a community water fund as well, which is several hundred thousand, which community groups can apply to get funding to do little bits of work around their local stream or try and put in little projects to try and engage the local communities to make that connection back to their local river. So there's, again, you know, as I mentioned at the start, there's huge interest, public interest outside the farming sector as well in water quality and trying to get back that connection with the land and where our food comes from. So there are huge opportunities for sure.
Absolutely. We have a question, it's kind of a recurring question about that separating the contribution of agriculture versus urban populations to water quality. Could you just explain to us how the EPA does that? How do you disaggregate the impact or the pressure from urban versus agriculture?
So the assessment, as I mentioned, is very comprehensive. It starts with the data in the stream so that we, or the river or the lake, so we can see the assemblage of pollutants or contaminants that are in the river. And that first of all gives us a clue. It gives us pointers towards what the likely source is. Then we go back up into the catchment and we look at activities that are going on in what soil types. At what times of the year do we see seasonal trends, for example, in the data that might point to a land spreading thing, or is it more continuous discharge that's consistent all during the year that would reflect more of a point source or more of an urban wastewater signal? We also then have for all of the water treatment, well, a good portion of the water treatment plants or the wastewater treatment plants, we have upstream and downstream monitoring of those discharges. And we have monitoring of the discharges themselves that Irish Water or Uisgearán are obliged to do. So between the discharge monitoring and the upstream and the downstream monitoring of where the discharges come into the river, you get a fairly good picture fairly quickly of what the impacts of those urban wastewater facilities are. So we know there are about 200 water bodies that are impacted by urban wastewater. And when we identify those as a significant pressure, they go on to our national priority list for Uisgearán to bring into their capital investment program. So that's an ongoing rolling process. When we see the evidence of the urban wastewater plants in the water, that gets onto our EPA priority list, which then goes into the investment program, and Uisgearán use their resources to fix those as a matter of urgency. So we are seeing declines. It's much or declines in the numbers of treatment plants that are a problem. It's the rate of improvement is slower than we would like, but we everyone is keeping the pressure up on Uisgearán to keep the investment coming.
Very good.
There's a question here. Should real-time monitoring as used by the ACP catchments be extended to more at-risk catchments being monitored by the EPA? Or is there technology and the cost of that technology getting to be within the realms of possibility for a broader application?
This is a really good question, and we get it a good bit. I think it's really important to think about monitoring in terms of the purpose of what you're trying to achieve. So the National Monitoring Program that EPA are responsible for is a monitoring program that's answering the question, what is the condition of our waters? That's what our role is to look at the condition of waters. And so the monitoring program that we have is targeted to be widespread, to be representative of all the different landscapes and settings that we have, and to be reasonably frequent, not as frequent as the ACP, because that's unbelievably frequent. I'll come back to that in a moment. So it's the monitoring program has been set up to specifically answer that question. What is the condition of our waters? The ACP monitoring then is part of a research program. And the monitoring that's done there, as some of your listeners will be familiar with, is done every 10 minutes on nitrogen and phosphorus. It's extremely densely monitored at a small number of sites in each catchments because it's very expensive. It's a fantastic resource for research purposes. But the question being answered by the ACP monitoring program is, how are nutrients moving through the landscape? How does that vary with weather and soils? What happens when we change farm practice? You get a much better magnifying glass or lens or understanding in a research sense about processes and dynamics and how nutrients move through the landscape. And we use that learning and that understanding to develop the pit maps that I've showed before. So all of the science that the ACP and the research and the knowledge has been embedded into what we now have, which is the tools to target the evidence. But there, I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that they're monitoring programs for very different purposes to answer very different questions. It would be complete overkill and misuse of the public resource to try and replicate a 10-minute sampling program in a national context to answer the question, is there a problem? We know there's a problem from the monitoring that we've got. The value of the ACP monitoring in limited areas is to try and understand why there's a problem. So it's horses for courses.
Okay. We're just coming up towards the end of our hour. Pat, is there one burning question you have for Jenny?
I suppose there's a question there about the potential for farmers and others to get involved in citizen science to assist in this process. Are there, I suppose, opportunities for it? We've seen it in other areas, I suppose, particularly on the biodiversity side. But are there opportunities in relation to citizen science for water quality?
Yes, there are. And there are some very citizen science-friendly monitoring techniques that people can do in their own local streams that look at the insects, and you can tell from the different types of insects that are in the river hiding under the rocks whether you're at high or satisfactory water quality or not satisfactory. And there are some quite simple indicators in those insects that will help you do it. And there are training programs, citizen science training programs available to help understand that. And those are I would say, being rolled out more and more across the country by the Rivers Trusts and the community groups that are springing up all around the place. The community water officers, I would say, and the LawPro website would be the best place to start for any of your listeners that are interested in getting involved in that. There are initiatives all over the place and plenty of tools available to do that, yeah.
Great. And getting the next generation involved, of course, is important as part of that also. Jenny, thank you so much. We always enjoy your presentations because they give a really great picture of where we're at this point in time in terms of water quality, but also your in-depth knowledge of the agricultural side of things as well is really important there. So thank you for that. And I think the numbers of people tuning in this morning is testament to the level of interest that's out there in terms of water quality in the country. And I think, as I said, there is that attitudinal change happening. I think that tolerance for the poor practice is definitely has reduced enormously, and farmers are now calling out the people that aren't necessarily that aren't following good practice.
I think Jenny, Mark, though, just one comment, and I think we need to turn that change of attitude into an urgency of action now, particularly over the next year, yes, to try and make sure that we see changes in some of the riskier behavior that's out there.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, look, hopefully today people will get a good strong messages from today. And also, look, there's lots and lots of resources there between the EPA and Chagask websites as well for further information. So we won't be with you next week on account of Good Friday. So in two weeks' time, we will have our 200th episode, and we're going to be discussing organic production and the market opportunities for organic food. And we'll be joined by Emmett Doyle, who is Organic Sector Manager with Bord Bia, and Joe Kelleher, who is Organic Specialist with Chagask. So do join us for that interesting webinar. But until then, thanks for tuning in, and we will look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks' time. So thanks, Jenny, again. And Pat, thanks for helping with questions. And a big thank you to Yvonne, of course, in the background, who's helping with all the technical side of things this morning. So we will talk to you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to the podcast version of the Chagask Signpost Series, the weekly webinar that promotes and examines sustainability in Irish farming. Don't forget to join us live every Friday morning for our latest webinar. For more, visit chagask.ie. And you can also rate, review, and subscribe to the Signpost series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Mark Gibson, and thanks for listening.